Good morning, church. It's good to see you all. Good to be back with you all. It seems it's been a very busy time for a lot of folks. I know that our teens have been going on trips. We've got families who have been going on trips. And I am thankful that we went, our family got to go on a trip. We went out west, and my nephew is working with a church in Fresno, California. We got to visit with them on Sunday morning, really fascinating congregation. And then we went on to some national parks out in California. It was amazing. This was one of my favorite moments. This is from a hike my son convinced me I needed to do. My son's 22, in great shape, and obviously I am also, but he wanted to do all these hikes, and so that's what we did. And it was getting late afternoon on one of the days we were at Yosemite, and we decided to go to one particular spot. And we get there, and there's a divergence in the trail. You can go 1.6 miles that way or 1.6 miles that way. And there was another couple who was going the opposite direction from where we'd planned to go. So we just asked, is that a good trail? And they said, sure. So we just went that way as well. And we found ourselves going up on top of a big bald mountaintop, so to speak, right in the middle of Yosemite Park. And we could see the whole park laid out before us as the sun began to set. It was just a beautiful, beautiful moment. So we had a really great vacation. We looked forward, of course, to going to that for a long time. And I can tell you that we also really looked forward to getting back home by the time it was all said and done. That's the way vacation goes, isn't it? We get so excited about going, and then by the time it's over, for most of us, we're ready to be home. It feels like some of those situations, even when it's good things, some of them are unwinnable type situations. We call it sometimes a catch-22. And there are lots of examples of these sorts of situations that exist all around us. They're in the workplace, in the red tape that goes on there, in government bureaucracy, even in our personal lives with family and friends and relationships. We get into these catch-22 situations. I was trying to think of one, and with our family having a newly minted college graduate, I thought of one particularly common catch-22. Sometimes it's called the work-home catch-22. And it goes like this. For most jobs, you need a stable home address, right? Employers require it now for pay, for background checks, for benefits paperwork, all sorts of reasons. You've got to have a stable home address. But if you actually want a stable home address, whether it's to rent an apartment or a home, you need proof of employment. You need a stable history. You need a job history. You can't just rent a home anymore on a handshake and a smile and a promise I'll be good next month. Right? It's a catch-22 sort of situation. That means that even if you're trying to desperately get onto your feet, if you're doing everything you possibly can, some people can find themselves locked out. It's a hard situation. So what do you do? How do you break that cycle? How do you get a job when you don't have an address? How do you get an address when you don't have money or a job? Well, in Mark's gospel, we're presented with perhaps the ultimate catch-22. It's a catch-22 that's a matter of life and death. So to set the stage a bit, I know I've missed a week or so, but we got to go back to what just happened in Mark's gospel. And remember, Jesus asked them, who do you say that I am, or who do men say that I am? And they believed Jesus to be the Messiah. Peter spoke up for the group and says, well, you're the Messiah. And at that statement by Peter, that Mark moment of faith, it's the turning point in Mark's gospel. Everything before Mark's gospel is leading up to that point. Everything from this point forward is leading towards Jerusalem. It's the pivot point in the entire gospel. So immediately, Jesus begins telling his disciples how he's got to go to Jerusalem and how he's going to have to suffer and how he's going to have to die, how he's going to be betrayed and killed by the leaders of Israel. And Peter, it's like that has blown his mind. He's just called Jesus the Messiah, just called Jesus Christ. And he can't process Jesus saying, I've got to go die. So he pulls Jesus aside to correct him, to rebuke him. And Jesus begins the process of helping his disciples understand what it means. You know that I'm the Messiah, but you don't know what Messiah means. So he's helping them, teaching them, showing them what it means that he is the Messiah. So the teaching we're looking at this morning is right on the heels of that. And it gives, I think we'll call it Mark's definition of discipleship. In other words, if you want to follow Jesus, if you want to know what it means to be a follower of Jesus, in Mark's gospel, it all gets boiled down to this right here. If you take nothing out of this morning's sermon, that'll be just fine. Nothing I say is going to be of any importance, but what Jesus says right here in Mark's gospel is pivotal for your discipleship. If you say you want to be a Christian, you say you want to be a follower of Jesus, you have to get this. And this is what Jesus says. Jesus calls the crowd along with his disciples to him, and he said to them, if anyone wants to become my follower, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and for the gospel will save it. For what benefit is it if a person gains the whole world yet forfeits his life? Or what can a person give in exchange for his life? For if anyone is ashamed of me, and in my words, in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Now, even if you've never heard this, if you're a new Christian or if you're not yet a Christian, even if you've never read this passage, I'll bet you're familiar with some of the phrases that come out of this particular passage. One of the ones that's become popular even in our culture is the idea of bearing your cross, right? You have a really cranky boss at work, well, that's your cross to bear. If you have a car that keeps breaking down no matter how much money you pour into it, well, that's your cross to bear. Now, are you saddled with financial debt? Are you struggling with a lingering health issue? Or you don't like some politician in office, or you've got shoes that are uncomfortable, that's your cross to bear. All sorts of things can be your cross to bear. Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but that's not what Jesus is talking about here. That has nothing to do with what Jesus is saying right here. Now, it'd be nice, it'd be really nice if it would make it that easier. It would kind of make it easier to swallow. It would soften what Jesus is saying. It would be like seeing a grizzly bear and say, oh, let's make an image of that, right? It's not the same thing. It's still a bear. Oh, that's what we do when we take Jesus' statement and say, oh, it's, you know, because my jeans are too tight or because I've got a leak in my roof. We can't do that with the words of Jesus. Because Jesus meant it exactly the way he said it. Jesus is not talking about accepting discomfort or inconvenience or momentary trouble. He's talking about a loss of life in a shocking and horrifying manner. That's what Jesus is talking about. It's not about your boss at work. It's not about your spouse that's a nag. It's not about any of those things. Jesus is talking about a shocking and horrifying loss of life. Now, of course, we believe Mark's gospel is the earliest gospel written before any of the others. And at least it's the earliest one that seems to be in circulation. And when Mark wrote his gospel, even early on, pretty well everybody knew the story of the cross. In fact, especially Christians would have already known the story of the crucifixion, right? Those stories circulated by word of mouth long before the written word was got out. So the story of the cross was already out there. Mark doesn't have to explain what Jesus means about bearing the cross. It would not have been shocking to Mark's first readers to hear this. I'll tell you who it would have been shocking for, though, is those who heard it the first time. Like the disciples and the crowd who are with Jesus, that day. When Jesus says this, it's meant to be a vivid and horrifying picture of a death march with all its shameful publicity. And it's also tempting to think maybe Jesus is also just saying this to the 12. Maybe he's just talking about how the disciples, which we referenced earlier, how the disciples, and Nick's thing, how the disciples were led on these lives that ended in sad and horrific deaths. Or some, including John the Baptist, or not John the Baptist, John the Apostle, died on the Isle of Patmos in exile. But most of the others were executed, horrifying style. So maybe Jesus is just meaning this for those 12, for those disciples, those who we later call apostles. But Jesus isn't just saying it to them. Remember in the passage, it said he called the crowd to him as well. So the fact that the crowd is there in addition to the 12 means this is not just a you 12 guys thing. This is an everybody thing. This is a you and a me. And anyone who wants to be a follower of Jesus has to get this. Now, in the 1950s, Parker Brothers, no relation, came out with a game for church families. You may have heard of it. It's called Going to Jerusalem. Very popular game. You probably got some of these right beside Monopoly and Boggle in your house. Now, Going to Jerusalem, the playing pieces were not worldly like the Monopoly pieces. There was no, you know, top hat or race car or Scotty dog. No, in Going to Jerusalem, every player is a real disciple. So each one is a little plastic guy with a robe and a beard and some sandals and a staff. And then in order to move around the board, players would look up answers to questions. They had a little black New Testament that was provided with the game. And you always started the game in Bethlehem. And then you made stops along the game in Mount of Olives or Bethsaida or Capernaum or on the stormy sea or in Nazareth or Bethany. And if you roll the dice well, you might make it all the way. Eventually, the home run, the end of the game, was to get to the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. That was the whole goal of the game, was to make it all the way to the triumphant entry to Jerusalem. But nobody ever made it to the crucifixion. There were no demons. There's no angry Pharisees. There's no jeering crowds. No rejection. There's no loss of family or friends or position. Players basically hopped from nice story to nice story to nice story about Jesus. It was a perfectly safe adventure suited for a Christian family on a Sunday afternoon walk with Jesus. But that's not what Jesus is talking about here. What Jesus calls for is a radical abandonment of your own identity, of your own destiny. Like wherever it is you think you're going, give all that up. This is a call to join Jesus on his march to Jerusalem and face execution. And that's when Jesus presents us with this catch-22. Because when you hang on to the things that you value most in this life, and these are the things that we value most naturally in life. As human beings, we all have things that are most valuable. If I came to you and I said, I want you to write down a list of the five things that are most valuable to you in your life. And I'm not just talking about, you know, worldly possessions, but you might write those down. And you might say your house or your car or your 401k, but you might also say, you know, your spouse or your children or your job or your role in the community or, I mean, some other intangible thing, your health, your identity. There's all sorts of things you might write down. I said, I want you to write down the five things that are the most valuable to you. Now, I want you to take all five of those things and I want you to fold them up. And I want you to give all five of them away. That'd be pretty hard to do, wouldn't it? I love my wife. I love my kids. I like my job some days. We all have things that we love dearly. And I think if my house went away, if my house burned down, it would be awful and I'd lose a whole lot of possessions. But that's not what I value the most. The things that I value the most are the intangible things. The relationships I have with my parents or my kids. I value the relationships I get to have with you all. And if Jesus comes to me and says, I want you to give all of that away, that's a catch-22. Because when you hang on to the things you value most in this life, the things we want to value and hang on to do that is to forfeit true life. The only way to get anything is to give up everything. That's what he's saying. Now, you may have heard these verses somewhat differently. Sometimes they'll use the word soul, right? I use the word life up there. You can find versions of the Bible that use the word soul. You find that use the word life. But the Greek word here is the same throughout. It's the Greek word psyche. It can mean your physical life, but oftentimes it carries a deeper meaning. It's not just your ability to breathe and have blood running through your veins. It's a much deeper meaning. It is yourself. It is your identity. It is who you are on your deepest level. Now, it's the most natural thing in the world. Of all the things we value, this is the most valuable, who we are, right? It's the most natural thing in human inclination to do whatever we can to maintain some semblance of what we've scrapped together. A little comfort, a little wealth, a little power or love or respect or health or safety. We will do whatever we can to hang on to those things. That is who we are. Think of it like this. I took a few economics classes, but I am by no means an economics major. So I'm going to make this really simple. We have a free market economy. And that means a lot of things, but to boil it down really simply, we want to get as much good stuff as we can get for as cheap as we can get it. And we sort of have an economy that's built for that. There's a lot of flaws with it, but that's basically the gist of it. If you and I could both go out and get the same new car and I can get it for $1,000 cheaper than you, I win. If we can both sell our homes that are actually equal value and you sell yours for $10,000 more, you win. That's the way our economy sort of works. You get as much as you can get for as cheap as you can get it. But this is not a free market economy. This is the economy of the gospel. And in the economy of the gospel, the only way to get the one thing you need is to give up everything. It doesn't matter if you've got 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 or 100 million. Whatever it is, whatever you have, the only way to get the one thing you need is to give up everything you have. Saving your life, saving your soul, saving your identity depends entirely, 100%, not on how smart you are, not on how right you are, not on how often you go to church, not on who your mama or your grandmama or your grandfather or your country. It doesn't depend on any of those things. The only thing it depends on, 100%, is becoming a disciple of Jesus. Nothing else matters. It doesn't matter what version of the Bible you prefer to read and you think you're smarter because you read the King James or you can read it in the Hebrew or the Greek. It doesn't matter if you go to a Church of Christ or a Baptist church or Catholic church or Presbyterian church and you think you've got the right doctrine there. It doesn't matter how great a Christian your parents were or how great a Christian your grandparents were. It doesn't matter how often you show up in the pew. It doesn't matter how great prayers you pray. What matters is, are you a disciple of Jesus? Oh, and I'm so thankful. Whose kids are amening? It was over there somewhere. They just reminded you guys, we're an amen in church. Amen? Amen. So Dietrich, somebody's doing it right over there. That's right. How many of you have heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer? I've talked a little bit about him in a sermon before. He was a Christian theologian and teacher. Ultimately an author, and he ends up suffering and dying because of his Christian faith. There have been some movies made about him. some of them are really bad. So I'm not recommending you go out and just watch any Bonhoeffer movie, but he's a fascinating figure. He lived and worked and taught and ministered in pre-Nazi Germany leading up into World War II, all the way up and through that time. And his goal through that was to continue to be a Christian. Sometimes he got it right, sometimes he got it wrong by his own confession. But he ultimately ends up being imprisoned in a Nazi Germany prison and being executed just days before the end of the war, April 9th, 1945. And he, if you go back and read his writings, like from the time before he was ever in prison, from before his persecution, from well before his death, if you go back and read that stuff, it is, one, it's amazing. One particular book, The Cost of Discipleship, I think everybody should read it. But it's what makes it fascinating to me is that when you read that stuff, it's almost like Dietrich Bonhoeffer knew this was coming. Not specifically how Nazi Germany would play out, not specifically how he would be in prison, but his writings indicate how he knew his end was going to be all along. So one of my favorite quotes comes from him, and this is what he said. He said, "The cross is laid on every Christian. As we embark on discipleship, we just surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death. We give over our lives to death. Thus it begins. The cross is not the terrible end, but it meets us in the beginning of our communion with Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die." Church, my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation is that we all be a people who will come and die. And that does not make a great church brochure. It doesn't look good on a website. It doesn't sound great on the radio, which this will probably show up and drive more people away in droves. But that's exactly what Jesus is saying. Come to me and find true life, but it's going to require you to give up what you've got. Your relationship with your family, your business, your home, everything you've got comes to me. And sometimes Jesus doesn't do with it the way I want it to be done. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. My prayer is that we will be a coming and dying people. And if you, as your walk with discipleship, have sought instead to hang on to your life, today's the day to give it up. If we can encourage you, pray for you, lift you up, we want to do that this morning. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?